The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. When have we never said that? Here we go. Valentino Rossi had a good start.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 336 for Wednesday, the 12th of September, 2012. My name is Jim Race. I'm in the Sierra Nevada foothills of Northern California. With me is Jules Cheesek down in the Bay Area. Good evening, Jules.
Good evening, Jim.
Good evening to you, sir. We've got a pretty good show for you guys. No interviews, I don't think, but it's just been one of those weeks trying to get people together. But I don't know about you, Jules, but I'm kind of thirsty. So do want to mention we had some awesome donators in this last week. Very, very cool. Always, you guys, I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. It does really help keep the show moving forward. Folks by the name of Gene Cook, Martin Gurney, and Lipinski. I think at least two of those gentlemen have donated in the past, but some very, very well appreciated stuff there.
Well, Lee goes way back to the Bob days. Lee and Bob and I used to camp at Laguna Seca, and he only recently started listening to the show because he's now driving a truck across the country back and forth. So he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go check out Motopod. And he sent a very nice message to me saying, man, this show's gotten good. So glad you enjoy it, Lee. And we had some adventures at Laguna. I think it was Bob's son, who I was shamed now, tried to ride up one of the hills in archery in his old car and like got it stuck. We had to try to push it out of the dirt. It was ridiculous. It was, of course, in the middle of the night, and everybody was drunk. So,
but when you say adventures at Laguna Seca, that's usually surrounded by parentheses and quotation marks and about everything else.
Yeah.
A ton of listener feedback this week, and
you know what? I actually wanted to suggest is let's do the news first, so that there's some context.
If we need to,
because we sometimes like talk about the listener emails. I think maybe some of the news that has some effect on this stuff. So.
Well, is there really any news this week?
A little bit.
So just for you guys out there, today is indeed Wednesday. So which is probably a good thing for us, Jules, because we did catch the announcement
that
Ben Spies has joined or will join Andrea Iannone at the Pramac squad. They're going to be continuing as the primary sponsor. I have to wonder, Jules, it popped in my head this morning when I finally read it, even though, you know, we'd been talking about it, not necessarily been talking about it, but had a pretty good idea for a while, that Ben joining them had something to do with Pramac returning, because there was word that they may not come back. So they're going to call it the Ducati Junior team, and that's something that's been in the works basically all season. In fact, they even talked
about it years ago.
Last year, yeah. They're saying with full factory bikes, or at least to start with. So it might be kind of similar to, one can hope, I will preface it with that, to the comparison between the, factory Yamaha squad this year and, the Tech 3 squad, who they basically kind of started off all on the same, you know, machinery to some degree. So an opportunity to, should the 2013, whatever they're going to call it, the GP13, maybe that's a bad omen, huh?
Is 13 a bad luck in Italian? I don't know.
If you're Italian out there and 13 is a bad number, let us know. It is in the States, or at least sometimes it's considered to be unlucky. So that's kind of a big deal. And then that leaves us, Jules, with the other remaining seat, right?
Yep. Which is the Gresini Honda seat, which I think there was some talk about. Obviously there was some talk about Ben going there. There was worries that the preference of the sponsor, San Carlo, would be that it would be an Italian rider.
But San Carlo has moved into the UK to sell now.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so with Johnny Ray going to be so the options are, let's just throw these out, is perhaps Bautista staying, bring up Scott Redding, maybe, or with Johnny Ray, who's going to be riding very soon. Is that this weekend?
This weekend.
Yeah. I can't even keep track, man. Johnny Ray riding for the factory Repsol squad on, in theory, Casey Stoner's Honda, probably in reality, my guess is. A good run for him may put him in a good spot for perhaps taking the Grassini ride, which is something earlier this season, Jules, I couldn't have necessarily seen that happen. But as quickly as they snatched him up to ride Casey's bike, you never know. You never know.
Well, certainly there's going to be support from Dorna for a British rider to be on a serious machine.
Sure.
We only have James Ellison right now, and he's on a CRT that's battling for a point usually.
Yeah. Well, I hear there's some guy named Crutchlow, and
oh, duh.
I'm just pointing that out. That's all right.
I'm an idiot.
No, we all do that. You're not allowed to edit it out. We all get to be that way. It will be interesting. It will be interesting to see how things pan out.
Well, that actually brings up a question. So how does Ray get the ride? I was just thinking along those lines. Well, Dorna wants a British rider, but you're right. We have a great British rider. And so how does Ray get this ride? So he's always been on the Honda.
Right.
He's been extremely loyal, and the Japanese reward loyalty. That's a huge, huge part of the culture. So,
and he won at Suzuka, remember?
Oh, and he won the Suzuka 8. That's right. Yeah. He hasn't had the best time in the last couple of rounds at Superbikes, but hopefully it hasn't. He's the kind of guy who just bounces right back. I mean, you know, he's always been riding. I don't want to say win or bin it, but he does definitely push the envelope. It doesn't mind crashing here and there.
I believe the term is that maybe you're looking for, and the term that I would use to apply to Jonathan would be flashes of brilliance. And that's the kind of thing that you kind of MotoGP needs right now is something unexpected. Now, granted, next year is going to, who knows what's going to happen, because we've got a lot of riders moving around, Casey Stoner moving out of the series. Rossi going over to Yamaha. I mean, it's going to be a crazy mix up year. Yeah. And we'll never be able to tell anything from testing, right?
Right.
Never.
But so, you know, now looking at it from the Grassini team, which may actually be losing their factory support, because it's quite possible that LCR is going to be the premier satellite team.
Mm-hmm.
With Stefan Bradl, and because I mean, he's been a revelation,
right?
And but I'm still thinking that Grassini. I don't know. Scott Redding is a fairly known quantity in the paddock. He's extremely talented. Everybody's pushing for him to move up. He needs to be on a bigger bike
because he's a bigger guy.
Alvaro Bautista hasn't sucked.
Right.
So.
Well, unless you ask one Jorge Lorenzo.
Yeah. You know, everybody's allowed a little mistake here and there. or a bonehead move.
Yeah. I guess you're allowed one a year.
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting. What else do we have going on? You did mention, and I haven't listened to it yet, the Supcast, which starred Julian Ryder and actually, Dennis Noyes.
That Martin was the one who put that in there, and I have not been able to listen to it. I meant to listen to it on a train ride from work today, but I didn't get a chance.
Well, Martin's take is that from listening to them, it appears that Rossi's taken a massive pay cut to join Yamaha, as they had to invest a lot in Jorge.
Not a big surprise.
Off the interest in him from HRC. Go on.
That's not a big surprise.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not a huge surprise.
Yeah.
And I don't see Rossi racing for money right now. Anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's not like he's starving for cash.
Yeah. He's racing.
He wants to feel what it's like to, you know, fight for the wins again.
And so I think that's, you know, he wants to go out with his racing soul intact.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Plus, you know, a couple more wins with Yamaha. The rider that has won with the same manufacturer the most is actually McDoen. With 54 wins.
On a Honda, of course.
On a Honda.
Yep.
Whereas Rossi had 46, obviously, or 47, I think, by the end of the season. Oh, it was 46. It was 46. It's kind of insane.
Yeah.
You know, with Yamaha.
Interesting number. Well, I don't have any predictions for next year. None.
Okay.
I'm not going to go there yet. I mean, it's just too far out. Should we go into listener email now? Do you think we've covered most everything, at least on the MotoGP front?
Yeah, yeah. Mike Moynihan, who's a regular comment sender. You know, by the way, we have a lot of repeat people, and I think they get very comfortable writing to us. You know, and I think a lot of people are not writing in, and every once in a while they write in and say, "This is the first time I've been listening to the show for 5 years. This is the first time I'm writing in." Well, you know, don't be scared. Just write in.
Yeah.
You know, if you have an opinion or you disagree with something or just want to just say something, you know, if it's cool, we'll read it on the air.
And if you don't want us to read it on the air, you can tell us that too. We might just synopsize it for you, like we've done with let me see, Doug Edmonston once or twice.
Yeah, well, he didn't ask. That was that was our call for purposes of keeping the show reasonably,
yes,
you know, listenable. All right, sorry, Doug. yeah, so Mike Moynihan writes in. He says he's got three comments, and some are new, some are old. So one, Yamaha rolling out the 2013 M1 at Brno. It can only be seen as posturing. Yes, showing an early 1000cc prototype earlier during the 800cc era. Yes, that was a true preview. But showing early 1000cc prototype during 1000cc era, that is meaningless. It's a prototype class. And if the latest version is faster, Yamaha doesn't have to wait until 2013 to race it. They could line it up next race, take the engine allotment if need be, and roll it out in anger. If they could give Lorenzo an edge in his title hopes, do you really think they would wait until next season? And my answer to that is, of course not. They could very easily. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't use the bike if it happened to run well, you know.
Well, two comments on that. I don't know if Yamaha has checked in all their engines yet. It's possible they haven't. But if they have, and the new bike is new enough to where if there's a new engine and the engine mounts don't line up in the new chassis, you can't just slap one of the existing engines in there. And,
well, that's what he's saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, so secondarily, you know, during the 800cc era, we had a fair amount of 800 bikes rolled out in the middle of the season, and some of those were a fairly big deal. Now, granted, probably the most noteworthy ones were Ducati doing it.
Ducati always went really early. In fact, Ducati went before Yamaha did this year. Usually, they used to do it like in July. They already were on the track, you know.
Well, I think that was out of desperation.
No. I'm talking about early. Days, yeah. You know, yeah. 2007, 2008, they were always pushing the bike out early,
sure,
as soon as they could, with Vittorio Guarashi.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that I ruminated on, and we're going to talk about World Superbike in a bit, was in the end of 2007, Chaz Davis was offered to be the test rider for Ducati.
Yes, that's right, I remember.
Yeah. And certainly an interesting weekend for Chaz, but we digress.
He says, this is, I guess, point number two. Wish I made the comment 2 years ago before Rossi went to Ducati, but I felt that he should have gone to Formula One. He had nothing to gain and everything to risk by moving to Ducati. He was already seen as the greatest of an era. His star could not have gotten brighter. And even if he won another world title with the Italian make, the Ducati, he would still be seen as the greatest of an era. It would not erase the supporters of Hailwood, Agostini, Spencer, Roberts, etc. Some pundits would still make a case for someone else being greater. You could only lose by going to Ducati, and now we are even questioning if he was that great during his championships, only winning by timing with great machinery and with lesser rider competition. He went to Formula One and did something. That is the only way his star could have grown. Could have been seen as a great talent, having successfully crossed over. and could have been seen as one of the greatest racers of all times, two wheels or four. Remember, he was very fast during Formula One testing. So this is a good thing to talk about, because I think a lot of online, a lot of comments and various forums and stuff like that run along these kinds of lines, you know. But I think that this is, and no offense, Mike, but I just think it's a very fairly naive way to look at, you know, Rossi's decision-making process, because there was so much history about the Formula One thing. You know, it's like he was in the middle of a championship, and he almost won it, and you know, there was a lot of he realized he was very distracted in 2006 with the whole Formula One thing. He put his foot down. And he said, "Okay, that's it. I'm committing to this to MotoGP." And you know, it was nice flirting with the Formula One thing.
Well, what if he'd gone to Formula One and sucked?
Yeah, exactly. He could have sucked, and that would have been, you know. Again, no one's judging him as a failure because of Ducati. I mean, I take that back. There's a lot of people that say that, but I think that's wrong. I mean, I think that the failure was the marriage, right? They just didn't work well together.
Right.
And, you know, anybody who's dismissive of Rossi's previous, you know, challenges and championships, you know, that opinion I hear all the time, and I just ignore it. I dismiss it myself. It's just, it's silly. You know, we can measure the success of a writer in so many ways. And did Agostini or Hailwood have easy years? Sure. Did they have hard years? Sure. But, you know, they also, Agostini, for example, was incredibly fast and rarely crashed. That's an incredibly rare skill, especially back in those days, right? Where you're riding on these tires that, you know, came apart in the corner and stuff. So
my thought is that it is that, from the online banner you see where people are taking up this position of, you know, is this a black mark on his career? They're probably not necessarily looking at his career very objectively. And I think if you do that, there's no way that you can't look and go, well, yeah, he was at the top. At the top, and he certainly was at the top of his game for many years. People always want to be able to name a greatest of all time, you know, the GOAT. Yeah. I'm not even sure how great an exercise that is. There's just a series of great riders, you know, the list that Mike put in this, you know, Hailwood, Agostini, Spencer Roberts, those kind of guys. Nothing wrong with being in a list like that. The value of numbers and the number of races won in these records, ultimately people are going to remember, frankly, a combination of the the races won and the championships won and the personality of the rider. And each of those guys, maybe with the exception of Freddie, because he didn't have much of one, had fantastic personalities.
And
you know, that's, to me, that's a part of what I think of the legacy of a racer.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the kind of passion that they bring to the sport and then exude out to the people who are watching the sport. You know, it's like, you know, it's like there's certain actors you like because they, but they may not even be very good actors. They're just really cool people. You know, Jack Nicholson, I think, is not a great actor. He's just in real life a super cool dude.
Yeah.
And so he always he's just himself, you know?
Absolutely.
Has he ever played a character? No, the characters are shaped to him, you know, and yet people love him, you know. They love watching him. So anyway, totally going off track here.
Yes.
The most important part of Mike's email is
oh, please.
And finally, Jim, a few shows ago, you said that you didn't make a bet on the CRT making the box. And actually, you did, and Jules would call him on it. And actually, Mike, Jim just said he didn't bet money on it. So, and yeah, the season is not over, as Jim put it here in the notes.
Yeah, And then I chuckled. I think I've been saying for at least the last couple of shows that I've done that I don't really necessarily expect a CRT bike to be on the box this year. But there is a bit of talk on the next one, on the next email, on what the possibilities might be. And I think I've said that at the very beginning, what's going to be said. So actually, let's move straight into that. If I did, and whoever I bet a six-pack of beer against, hopefully it was against John Hart, and then, you know, I'll just take it out of whatever he owes us. or Martin, the beer account. Next coming up, Nick Codling. Hey, Nick, thanks for writing in again. He says, the CRT talk from the indie cast, he said it was interesting. I don't know whether it's depleted grids due to injury or front runners crashing out, but it seems to me like the CRTs have definitely closed the gap. So this is an alternate opinion, by the way, Jules. Some people think they have, some people think they haven't. As Martin Raines quite rightly said, they're not the fire-breathing exotica that we get from the factories, and it would be a sad day if that's how MotoGP ended up. But listening to the guy doing Steve's Rap's bike, and he forgot his name, but as it turned out, that was actually Jeff Maloney talking about that.
And so that's Aaron Yates' bike.
Yes, indeed. He said, CRT has really made the MotoGP grid relatively accessible. It has now. That Indy run with two bikes qualifying was very important. That's for me. And he said, carries on. He says, that's no bad thing at all. It's kind of nuts when you see massive grids for Moto3 and Moto2, and then MotoGP comes along, and we can't even make 20 runners. That's money, right? It would be really great to see more wildcards. I absolutely agree. And perhaps a bit more of an infrastructure in place where CRT machines might become more available and become financially viable to run. Before I carry on, we do have the specter, if you will, of a potential Honda CRT bikes. We haven't heard a whisper of that since they first put that out, though, have we, Jules?
No, but we love to talk about them.
Yes, well, they brought it up first, damn it.
Yeah. No. I think it's awesome.
I think it's neat. Yeah, it's funny to just kind of lay it out there and then keep it in the dark. Anyway, he says, my main point is regarding the difference in performance. The CRTs are finishing better and better and even qualifying closer now. The gap does seem to be narrowing. I suppose realistically, it will be impossible, almost impossible, for privateer teams to ever match the pace of factory development. But I agree. So always remain two-tier. And I'm not sure if I agree with that, Nick, because with, you know, a spec ECU coming out and also potential of an RPM limit, things might really tighten up. Mm-hmm. But carrying on, he says, my feeling is that a podium would have to be as a result of some freaky conditions, maybe rain or several front runners being taken out in an incident, but they're not that far off.
It would really take a lot of front runners, by the way, because you have to think of, there's probably 9 riders that always beat a CRT.
Well, maybe it'll be like a World Superbike weekend.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I mean, you know, there was Motegi in 2007 when we had the flag-to-flag race and Caparossi was just floundering back there. And all of a sudden he won the race because of the way he happened to enter the pits just at the right time. You know, get out in the wets just perfectly right. Everybody else had to slow down big time. I think it was Nakano that like decided to stay out of the slicks for way too long, and he was basically like lapping like 20 seconds slower at that point. But he was in the lead anyway. So yeah, there's definitely situations like that. We just, you know, it's just hard to imagine.
Well, if they go to a single bike rule, as has also been talked about,
that rule's gonna have to change.
Well, that could make that could make, you know, changing out discs and wheels and all that. That could make things even kind of weirder if we had because I'm assuming that, well, those will be flag to flag races as well. I can't see them actually stopping the race, letting them come in. I don't know. Who knows what the hell's going to happen. anyway.
Okay. No, because you know, that last week, the 24 hour Le Mans, series, the motorcycle 24 hour Le Mans race was on, and I saw a video from one of the pit stops, and I was like, this would be cool in MotoGP. Not at every race, because then it becomes Formula One, where the strategies, the races are won and lost in the pits. But if we had a flag-to-flag and only one bike rule, it's pretty neat.
Well, okay, so endurance is a little bit different because you're changing riders, you're changing tires, you're changing fuel because you're out. Now it would be interesting. You put a thought in my head and I'm going to just park it out there and we should get some writing in about that. What if we made MotoGP races longer? And they had to pit for fuel.
I think that one of the greatest things about MotoGP and Superbikes is the length of the race. It doesn't mean I could still go out for a ride after.
Yeah, well, and that's one thing that I think I talked about an article last week. If I didn't, I still want to link it up. It was actually written by somebody that doesn't normally talk about the sport, and they said one of the reasons why MotoGP should
that was like
be
a
more
couple
popular,
weeks ago. Yeah.
Because it's so neatly packaged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. But I'm just going to throw that out. How about a race that lasts for 50 laps and they actually have to pit for fuel and tires? Huh.
that's my worry. I think that then you might have, races that are won and lost in the pits. Look at incidents that happen in the pits in Formula One that somebody runs the back of somebody because they weren't supposed to leave the pits yet. Safety cars, also some bullshit like that. I don't know. I like the purity of just go out there, go around until you see the checkered flag, then stop.
All right. Sorry, I like it too. I was throwing that out just as a point of talk. All right, back to Nick. Nick says, he says, it takes me back to the good old days when World Superbike was massive in the UK. For myself and my brother, the annual pilgrimage to Brands Hatch in the summer was something never to be missed. We'd arrive early, our bikes loaded up with camping equipment and lots of beer. Where possible, we blag our way on into the paddock or pits and generally get burnt to a crisp in the traditional brand sunshine. Happy days. Back when Foggy was running the Petronas bikes, I'd always be interested to see how they were doing. So right here, he's kind of still talking about the CRTs, just to tie that back in. Mm-hmm. He says, here was a small team with a big profile that was trying to do something different. An unusual engine and clearly a very sweet chassis. Sadly, they never made it big, but I remember standing there on South Bank, seeing the leaders come past and the Petronas bikes or bike trailing behind. And they didn't look any slower to me. They were still quick. They just lacked that little bit here and there that made a difference over a lap. But the point is, they were never that far behind. And this is the point with the CRTs. He says, all the riders are quick. Really fucking quick. Every single one of them. Think Petrucci's shit? And you say, no.
No.
Stick him in a 1990 CBR 600 and he's still run rings around you on your Panigale. The bikes are all quick. How many of us could really and truly say that we could ride a lap record pace for 45 minutes and not collapse with exhaustion, not make one single error? Not me. On a bike that weighs less than a packet of cigarettes, I'm gonna have to try and figure that one out. Nick, makes way more power than most people's cars. Maybe he's saying a bike that has a contact patch less than a pack of cigarettes. Anyway, he says, who out of us could even get within 15 seconds of the lap record pace? Seriously, I agree. The fact is, CRT bikes are what, maybe 3 seconds off the leader. One, two, three over lap. That's maybe a mile and a half or 2 miles long. That's pretty damn amazing if you ask me, that being Nick. What it also shows us is just how amazing the top guys are. A race could be settled by making one tiny error now. Go a foot off the line, bang, you've lost the lead. And you may not get it back because the bikes are so even. Finishing up, he says, as an observation, that was what made the Danny Jorge fight so interesting. Danny was suffering with tire wear, so was having to stand the bike up and use the Honda acceleration, or maybe Danny acceleration as he weighs less than a pea. One of his legs. Danny wanted to use sweeping flowing lines, so he closed right up on corner entry and lost out on acceleration because Danny was blocking him. Jorge wanted to use the sweeping flowing lines. It was great to watch. Must have bugged the hell out of Jorge. Amazing, though, isn't it, how Honda and Yamaha can independently build two different bikes, but ultimately they end up so close. Really amazing. That said, he says, this is Nick. He says, I'm still all in favor of an open anything goes class, superchargers, six cylinders, nitrous, whatever. How cool would that be?
And a $1 million prize?
Yeah. Doesn't that sound sound vaguely familiar? Well,
First of all, I have to go back to, the pretty amazing thing about the CRTs being only 3 seconds off the leaders. I do need to point out that the fastest Moto2 bike is only a second off the pace of the slowest CRT at Brno. Mm-hmm. This is based on looking at the mid-race laps when everything was warmed up and you know, they were hitting their rhythm. So that's, so as much as amazing as CRTs are, it's all relative, right? Because if you look at the fact that you've got a bike with a lot less capacity, you know, closer to the CRTs than the CRTs are to the prototypes, that could put things in a little bit of a different perspective.
You could make it kind of like club racing, where you could race up a class.
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of doing that now, I guess.
Yeah.
But overall, I have to say that I'm starting to warm up. You know, I think that I'm getting more and more stubborn in my old age, and it took me a while to get warmed up to Moto 2. I didn't have any issues with Moto 3, but I think it's because it was really just a different configuration. There was no, like, you know, standard engine, for example, the control engine or anything like that. That was my big issue with Moto 2. But yeah, I'm starting to warm up to the CRT thing. You know, just I still am concerned about who's going to be riding those things. And those guys, as Nick points out, they're super fast. They're very talented riders. I think Petrucci actually is a funny example, because I think Petrucci is amazing. I just think he really has a difficult package to ride.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he's got a bike that's in. If you believe some of the numbers that have been tossed around, close to 100 horsepower less than the fastest bikes.
Is it really that much? That's crazy. That's crazy talk.
Well, I've heard tell of some of the top MotoGP bikes right now making in the 270 to 275 range. Now, granted, that takes Nick's idea of, you know, superchargers, six cylinders, nitrous, all that stuff. It throws it out the window, because what everybody's doing is they're taking these bikes with 270 horsepower and they're turning around, they're dumbing them down with electronics. So with the advent upcoming of a spec ECU, which is going to happen, I don't think there's any way around it, and potentially a rev limit, having all of that it's great to have all that horsepower, because it gives you adjustability with your electronics. But when the adjustability of your electronics moves down a little bit, then you don't necessarily have to have all that. And if they come out with a set rev limit, let's say they do it like BSB did. BSB, I think, set it for 750 RPM above whatever the bike shipped with, right? So relatively reasonable limits. So let's say they give them 1,000 in MotoGP. Well, you still might see, you know, the factories turn around and build engines that take advantage of that configuration. You know, they don't need a rev so high. Your piston speed isn't flailing around in some atmospheric territory. And so you build the bike with a little bit of, you know, longer stroke or something like that. And you can build it with materials that are more durable, so that the amount of engines that you go through, your engine longevity lasts longer. I mean, and that's kind of the key to having a rev limit, right? It's not so expensive. You're not going through all these engines. And you don't have guys going out because they've got a blown engine. I don't know. It'll be interesting. But, you know, again, that's next year or the year after, when those kind of things come into effect. And as we get closer to the end of the season, Jules, those things are going to be talked about even more.
Yeah, because we're kind of closing down the silly season of the riders. I think the next silly season that's going to start is going to be, you know, are we going to get the rev limit next year, or is it going to be 2014? Are we going to get the ECU next year? Probably not. I think, well, actually,
probably
it is possible. It is possible next season. That's right.
Yeah. And again, I think a lot of people are looking at BSB, because BSB has had some fantastic racings with the spec ECU. A lot of the teams thought that wasn't going to work, and it was still great racing. And the ones that didn't think it was going to work have actually warmed to it now. So, you know, the guys that are actually in the trenches and doing this are like, yeah, well, okay, that didn't suck as bad as we thought it was going to suck.
Yeah.
There was a thought that I had and it completely drifted out of my head, but that's okay, because that's normal.
I also, by the way, share Nick's point about how amazing it is that Yamaha Honda built, you know, relatively different machines. And obviously, the M1 is an inline and the Honda is a V4. And that's the thing that always blows me away as well, because the rules are not that, there's not that many rules still in MotoGP. You know, you got capacity limits, bore stroke, and, you know, weight. And that's pretty much it. You know,
the all important fuel rail pressure.
Oh yeah, oh, right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. But in the end, the engineers still have a lot to work with, right? And sure. And so I agree with him that it is amazing that you know, two different manufacturers with different approaches, and even on the track you can see that the Honda's strength is coming out of a corner. The Yamaha's strength is going into the corner.
Yep.
And then they end up, you know, finishing just a few tenths of a second apart after 50 minutes. So that's all. I totally agree. It's freaking awesome. It's really, really exciting, I think. And
stuff.
I agree.
I agree too.
Let me summarize this next email from Alan. Sorry, did you have anything else to add to?
Carry on.
So Alan Fleming wrote in a very long, interesting email. I'm just going to summarize it because this is the point of the email that I thought was really interesting, which is that he thinks that, and I know you will agree, and I agree too, that it'd be cool to get a little more technical info. For the geeks, right? Like, it's pretty hard to actually dig this stuff out. You know, David Emmett at Moto Matters sometimes talks about some specifics, but he has to dig around for those. You know, there's no, like, go-to place where you can see, you know, what is it that, what are the, since the CRTs are based on production bikes, there's a lot less secrecy around that. So let's see more about the technology behind them. You know, we will definitely get some of that at the end of the year when Julian Ryder does his end of year review book. He always has a great section on the technical aspects of the different manufacturers' entries. And it's always a fascinating read, but it's still two or three pages worth, you know, and it's dumbed down. It's not super dumbed down, but it is fairly lame and kind of stuff. For me, it's good because that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge. But for somebody who's a real gearhead, I think that they wanted like a Kevin Cameron kind of, you know, here's a history of how this came about kind of thing. And, you know, so what Alan writes about is, you know, he wants to get more CRTs on the grid in 2013 with fewer factory bikes and see if we can get a little more visibility into what's happening with these bikes. Maybe getting more wildcard teams involved. We all agree with that. We'll invigorate the interest among fans in what really is happening technically at the highest levels of racing. But one of the examples he used was, you know, why is Suter BMW such a dog? You know, it'd be cool if it was more than just, well, it's a dog, it sucks, it's a piece of shit, which is what we've gotten from Colin. But what exactly specifically is a piece of shit about it, you know?
Well, I think part of the reason that we're not hearing that much information, and you're right, we'll get some from Julian Ryder's end of season book and maybe some from the journalists that will get to test these bikes at the end of the year, is that even within the CRTs, you got to think about it, especially on year one, there's still a lot of, you know, intellectual property and competitive advantage that these guys are still trying to set up. They're, you know, pouring maybe not the mega dollars, but mega dollars into this stuff to find their position, to secure their sponsorship. And to, so they don't want, you know, the other team that's using a different chassis, maybe with the same engine they are, to know what's going on. I think right now, to some extent, for the CRT bikes, because the engines are pretty much unknown, right? They're based off production engines. That the mad scientist portion of it is all in electronics and chassis. And you're not going to get the Suter BMW team telling you what's wrong. I mean, we've got...
Well, they will. They'll tell you exactly what is wrong. Electronics.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. Electronics, and I mean, you know, granted, what
halfway through the year, Colin got a bike with a different crank, and that weeded out some chatter that was giving him fits at the early part of the year. So there's, you know, parts of it are still engine too, but then they probably had to try and figure out how to tame that engine with the electronics. Colin's never said that he's down on power. He said it's just a bit of a light switch kind of thing. So I don't think they're going to give a whole lot away, much like the factory teams. I mean, you know, you want to know what's going on with the bike? You can buy it. Right?
Nice.
If you're a factory.
Yeah, but you know what? There's certain parts that remain absolutely a secret. But in Formula One, you can go and get the current season data about cars. It's pretty damn detailed. It's very detailed. And I'm sure that there is some stuff that's covered up and even fabricated some of the numbers. But there's a lot of info. A lot more than what we get from MotoGP. I'm just saying that, like, I see what Alan is saying, and with, because the CRTs are not as dramatically, you know, prototypish, it'd be cool to actually hear some more, you know, get guys like Jeff Maloney to talk a little more openly about what they're doing, you know.
Well, okay, so
because it'd be interesting, I think, to follow along with that
process
during the season, not just reading about it at the end, you know.
So let me make sure that I make myself understood. I would love to hear it too. Absolutely. I would totally geek out on it. I would love to hear all of the bits and pieces. I was not devil advocating. I was just saying why we may not be hearing so much about it.
No, I understand. I understand. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. All right. Shall we carry on?
And yeah, finally, you guys...
We glossed over.
You guys, well, you didn't glass over it. Actually, this came up. This is the email from Sheldon. Actually, Sheldon Gooey posted this on Facebook. He just said, where the CRTs now with respect to World Superbike times? This is after the Brno race. Because Brno, he says, was probably a good benchmark, which I totally agree with. And immediately I went out and grabbed Marco Melandri and René Depunier's lap charts. And when you guys talked about it with James Whittam, he was kind of dismissive. He's saying, well, you know, it's different tires, different situation, different conditions. You know, at some point you have to kind of, you have to say, okay, well, at least it was dry. It was the same track, it was the same length, unlike our faux pas with the Aragon thing, right? It's actually the same exact layout. It was dry. It was actually, temperatures were a little bit colder for MotoGP. But I think that it is worth pointing out that Depunier would have won that race.
Had they been racing together with the same tires and the same conditions at the same time.
Yeah, okay, but you know, but yeah, I mean...
Yeah, you can't do it, Jules. I mean, in reality, they're on the track, but then, at least at the
eventually,
same day.
Eventually, you're going to say, well, they have to be on the same exact bike.
No, yeah. I'm totally fine with that. They can be on different bikes, but data, every look at, and we're going to talk about this probably a lot when we talk about what happened at Nürburgring. But look at what happened from Saturday to Sunday. The bikes were 2 seconds slower. I mean, the same bikes on the same track.
Yeah, and that was actually also the case at Brno with MotoGP. They were significantly slower during the race than they were during practice.
So what it tells you is that from day to day comparisons, you know, they can't be done. I mean, it's fun. It's great speculation, but from a real racing perspective, which is why James was dismissive.
Well, but my point is that the in superbikes. At Brno, they were going at about the same pace, whereas the MotoGP bikes were slower, and the CRT still had better luck. I understand that this is not a scientific thing, but it is interesting to point out that the CRTs, in the configuration with the Bridgestone, the fancy Bridgestone tires that are made for the prototypes, and they have to work into that with the chassis design, would have done extremely well if they were in that field. So my point being that the CRTs are very fast.
Yes. Some of them. Yes, they absolutely are.
You know,
I'm not saying that they're slacking at all. It's just a different thing. I mean, even you could even go to the point where, carbon discs versus steel brakes. If you put all these guys in the same race, it'd be a total mess, to be honest.
Well,
as much as I think I brought it up.
But last year we were talking about CRTs and saying, well, I bet the CRTs won't even be, people were saying, but the CRTs won't even be as fast as superbikes. And people love to compare superbike lap times to MotoGP and say, look, they're only 2 seconds off, you know, blah, 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 blah. And my point is just that the comparison is made.
But I think you're hardly ever going to find anybody that's actually involved with racing that will agree that you can compare the things if they're not that close. It's still going to be apples and oranges.
Okay, but here's what I'm going to say. If we put a CRT bike that's set up for the Pirellis and a superbike that's set up for the Pirellis on the same track, I bet the CRT would be extremely competitive.
We're back in if land.
Yeah. I'm just saying, you know.
It might be. It very well could be. It's just hard to say, you know. The bikes are going to be going at very different sort of ways, as I said, especially with the carbon brakes.
Right. I'm just saying that a certain amount of variables have been removed. There's less variables in this particular round. It was worth talking about. Boom. Done.
All right. Where are we going now?
Superbikes at the Nürburgring. And boy, was that a wacky, wacky, wacky weekend.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, Nürburgring's a crazy track.
It is. Dude, that turn one, I mean, it's been 4 years now they've been going.
Yeah.
And they're still trying to figure it out. I love it.
For 4 years they've been back.
Yeah, that's true.
To be honest, to me, having raced, the final corner is scary as shit because A, you can't see through it. It's completely blind because there's this huge wall that you're basically almost Macau style dragging your arm against,
right,
your shoulder against. And I've seen guys turn in a little bit too early there and have to stand their bike up. I mean, there's a bunch of corners there. That being said, it's a neat track. It kind of looks like a rider's track.
Yeah, no, my point was about turn one is that I'm always, how many laps was that race?
20.
I think. 20? 20 yep. Exactly? Okay. I think I sat out of my seat at least 20 times because I'm always going, when they're coming into that corner, you know, like there's that anticipation, having seen races there before, of just all the different things, all the different lines people take, you know, they brake too late. Somehow they manage to stop and get her around. You know, it's a really cool track to watch racing at.
Totally.
You know, so absolutely. Yeah, very enjoyable.
So fire through qualifying for us.
Biaggi, Sykes, Landry, Leverty, Ray, Checa, Gamier, Baz. All right, so that's qualifying. yeah. Race one superbikes.
Weather was perfect, or at least close to perfect. It was a bit gusty.
Yes, it was a little bit gusty. I was going to say, the thing about race one was that Landry had moved on the grid, and even the comment, you know, it was I think it was Neil Hodgson that was commentating along with
Steve Day.
Yeah, Steve Day, right? And he would say, "Oh, Melange jump started," and I'm sure that Melange in the back of his mind had, "Oh yeah, I could get called in," you know.
Let's take an interesting little step back here, because going into this weekend, there was kind of a mindset, or there was a general thought, I think, from everybody that Biaggi might have been on his back heel a little bit with Marco taking the points lead,
mm-hmm.
and we've always kind of thought of Max as having a tendency to crumble a little bit when When he finds himself in a tough situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that we didn't want to see happen was for Max to go into one of his bad zones, his bad places, and for Marco to run off. But this weekend, clearly, Jules, did not end up like that, dude.
No, I mean, in so many ways. There's so many ways. I mean, and the thing is, Melandri is except for the year at Ducati, that he had at Ducati, he's an unbelievably confident rider.
And he's
confident
in his abilities. Consistent.
He's very consistent, and so and he already had an 18.5 point lead coming into this one. So, you know, he was just, the momentum was totally with him. And so that, so right from the start, it was like, oh, that's kind of, that could put a real, throw a little spanner in there, because if he gets called in for a jump start, surely he's not going to win the race, you know?
But I mean, you know, 3-4 laps in.
He didn't get called in for the jump start, but instead he decided to crash.
Well, there's that, but I mean, he still basically came up pretty quick through the field. And so whatever was in his head, and at the point where he crashed out of third place was well beyond where he would have been called in, because they'll usually do that in a lap or two.
I was going to say that that you're absolutely right, that I was thinking, well, he started from third, but because of the little movement, he actually ended up being on the back foot starting. So he was like, I think, 10th or 11th at the first corner.
Yeah, I don't think we ever got to see a replay of his start. I never saw one.
No, we didn't. We didn't. Yeah.
So I may have to go back and create my own, but to do so.
They did show it.
I mean, if Hodgson calls it, he probably knows it fairly well. He's got a little bit of experience with these motorbikes. But yeah, Melandri going out of third. Race one had a fair amount of crashes that were not necessarily surprising. I mean, Fabrizio had one of the most lofty, kind of like a U.S. Open lob high sides in, was it turn two or turn three? And I remember seeing that going, oh man, that's going to hurt. It was an excellent arc, though. So, Michelle, I hope you're feeling better. A 9.6 on.
he rode race two, so obviously it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, well, the one thing that was probably even worse, well, okay, granted, you're going to take a good slam to the ground. He didn't get run over. He was probably in the back third of the pack, which was great, but his bike with its rear wheels still probably at 120 miles an hour definitely gave him a kick as he got punted over the curb. And none of that's fun, and Michelle's not the biggest guy on the planet, so I'm glad you're fine, dude, or at least as fine as you can be.
Out front, however, Sykes was building up a nice sizable lead, and with Checa and company following, but Checa and Ray both crashed out in turn one. Sorry, Checa crashed out in turn one. Ray crashed in that the other really fast corner. It's like turn one. He's always crashing in that same place.
Yep.
You know. Anyway, but there's the big mystery of the weekend was what happened to Sykes.
I pondered that too, Jules, and I was thinking that they've managed to bring the bike up through whatever combination, be it taming the electronics or bringing the chassis in line, which has always been traditionally been the Kawasaki's weak point on the leader bikes. But one of the problems they were having early in the year was obviously, and as Hodgson said over and over again, it didn't look like it was a grip problem.
No, it didn't look like his tires were going. That's the whole point.
Yeah. He wasn't so it may be one of those things that we don't find out, because we didn't find out through race two either.
No.
I haven't heard word of it yet, but
the thing is, if they had made adjustments to his bike so that they wouldn't eat up the tires, it wouldn't be a drop in lap times.
No, not necessarily. No, I agree. I personally think he had a motor issue. I mean, that's the most simplistic explanation. If the bike isn't going off from a handling perspective, and it didn't seem to be,
mm-hmm.
something was going on where he wasn't, you know, his lap times were dropping pretty dramatically. And so, yeah. You know, they had a motor issue, not that out of the ordinary and not so surprising. They've had a very good run of luck.
Both races.
Yeah. No, but they got plenty of engines. Yeah, but you know, you could have had a different mistake that had to do with the motor for the next race, or, you know, it's got to remember, it's still the same heads in the pits that are making the same decisions. They may have said, okay, well, we'll tweak this because we think that's what it is. Well, maybe that isn't what it was. And right. The same issue occurred in race two. Until somebody tells us, I don't think we're going to know.
Yeah. And we probably won't.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in the end, you know, Biaggi came through and ended up taking the win. And that definitely changed things because Melange didn't finish the race. So he had 0 points, suddenly Biaggi's ahead by 3.5 points.
Yeah. And we had Aprilias all across the box for race one. And we'll talk more about that later, won't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had Biaggi, Laverty, and Chaz Davies. Chaz Davies had a great ride.
Not to mention, Biaggi had never been on the podium at Nürburgring.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're right.
Ever.
You're right.
So you got to give props to him. He kept a clear, calm head throughout the entire race. Race one, I'll point out. Just kind of, it pointed out one of the reasons why World Superbike is so fun this year, because it turned it didn't turn the championship on its head. It just turned it around a little bit.
Yeah.
Brought Sykes closer to the front. Brought Chaz Davies up further in the field and made for the potential of a really cool race too.
Yeah.
Because things had tightened up. You know, with Melange crashing out, he had 18.5 points going into that, and then Biaggi winning. Well, all of a sudden he's back in the lead after one race. You know, after race two, we'll talk about the standings a little bit, and it's amazing how much has tightened up. And we've only got four races left, two race weekends,
right? Yeah.
And so World Superbike's certainly going to be a barn burner down until the end. Should we move on to race two?
Sure.
It was later in the day. It was still windy.
Yep.
And it was still sunny. And it was still at the Nürburgring. And the track was still pretty much the same as it was. Not sure how many races they had in between. I believe the Supersport race was in between. We'll talk about that briefly. I haven't seen that yet, Jules. So, we may have to wing that one a little bit, but, race one set the foundation and the atmosphere for race two, didn't it?
Absolutely. And, we had a great start from Chaz Davies, and in this race, they had a great shot of the pack going through turn one from a camera that was at the apex.
Oh, yeah, the cherry picker cam. That was cool.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's just insane how the pack, when it all together, made it through that first corner. It's just amazing.
So here's what it reminded me of, Jules.
Yeah.
And you'll laugh because when I read your comment, and I watched it again. And what it reminded me of was some horrible slum where you walk into the kitchen, you flick on the light, and there's cockroaches all over the floor, and they all try and scurry to get out of the light through the same hole.
That is perfect.
That's kind of what it looked like, only there were much prettier motorcycles. But it was just completely kind of, say, chaotic, yet poetic ballet where they weren't bashing into each other. They were just getting really fucking close. And
I love that.
For however many bikes that were on the grid, there were that many number of lines through turn one. And
they all made it through. You know?
And they all went through that lap.
Yeah. On lap two, and Laverty was leading the race. He had a great start. And Biaggi was behind him. And I think Sykes was leading. Yeah, Sykes was leading. Laverty then passed him, and Biaggi was following. And Laverty ran off, and I think it was like in turn seven. I'm trying to remember, but it's kind of the uphill section.
Yep.
So the bike gets a little bit lighter, and Laverty went off, and it almost looked like Biaggi was focused on Laverty.
So well, I think he was trying not to run into the back of him because I think Eugene got on the binders. He got the rear end lofted.
No, I know. I'm just saying that at first I was like, because Biaggi crashed, but at first I was like, maybe he followed him through. But then when they did the replay, you're absolutely right. He looked like he just basically had to slam the brakes and he did it a little bit too hard.
Yep.
And he was already starting to lean. So he went down and crashed pretty fast corner. So he crashed pretty strong. Laverty was able to ride it out. He rejoined, I think, in 11th place. And then started making his way back up. And
big time.
The amazing thing is that Biaggi did get back up, but he was 20 something seconds behind the last rider. So he was way back there, but given the number of retirements in the first race, I forgot to mention there were 5 riders that retired. Only 2 riders, I mean, 17 riders finished. So,
you know, I have to wonder if he was thinking at that point, I just want to get through this race so I can mail these fairings off to Brent.
I love it. I love it.
We'll just leave that one out there.
Okay. I love it. Anyway, so he got back up and started riding again. And we had a great battle between Giuliano and Ray near the front. I really like watching Giuliano ride. But man, he's a wild man. He's a wild man. What does that mean again?
Lummox, Lummox.
Yeah.
Think of it as a... It's an actual beast, I believe, but think of it as a bull in a china shop.
Okay, yeah, got it. Yeah, absolutely. Big guy, kind of crazy. Get out of the way, he's coming.
Yeah. but not in like a Robin Arms sort of way. Just kind of in, I'm coming through, and it's probably in your best interest not to be on my line.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Meanwhile, Melandri is having a much better race because he was still on the track. And by around lap 7, classic textbook maneuver at Nürburgring, passed Sykes and took the lead. On the next lap, Chess Davies, who had the whole race, he was fantastic. He also passed Sykes. So we had
Chaz was totally dialed for that whole race too.
In
a way, he almost made it. I know it wasn't, but he almost made it look easy. And he did a Josh Hayes on the race. He just got out in front, found his lead, maintained it. And you got to remember that the guy took off from 10th on the grid, and he got up to the front quickly and held it there. But I mean, you know, as he said in the post-race interview, he said after race 2 that I knew that if I could get up there and be with the guys that I could go. He was just that comfortable that he felt on the bike. It was amazing.
He wasn't first yet because I don't think.
No, not yet.
I mean, it was on next lap that Melandri crashed just after Chaz passed Sykes in T1 a few corners later. Melandri crashed, and that was...
Shocking again.
Quite shocking. I really. Well, you know, he was pushing it.
Yeah, and it actually, if you think about it, now after race 1, he's got every reason to do so. He's been put into the position that we had, a lot of us had sort of ascribed to Max, that he was going, that Max might have been going into race 1. Well, now all of a sudden the shoe's on the other foot, and Marco's having to push it to perhaps try and get back some pride because, you know, those guys are the best of friends.
Well, I'm sure that the board told them that, in fact, there was a shout out the board that said, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The short answer is that getting to the front and maintaining your lead, a consistent lead without pushing too hard, is the smartest thing you can do in racing. I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
Right.
Go
just as fast as you have to win.
Exactly.
Only as fast, I mean, not just as, but only. Yeah.
But he wasn't the first to do that, was he?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you're talking about the weekend, I like that.
I mean, this was such a strange weekend in terms of who went out and who didn't make it to the end. But yeah, so two zero points for Melandri. Meanwhile, Biaggi was lapping at the same pace as the guys up front.
Yeah,
and that 20-second gap. Now, that's a massive gap, right? And then when they showed a shot of his bike, I mean, the left side of the fairing was just gone. It was totally torn up, which also means probably that the pegs were all messed up. So, and that's, you know, gearbox, everything from that side. So, incredible ride, and he ended up with finishing 13th.
Yep, salvage points. Well, and if you remember, in race one, Cheka, who crashed out, also remounted and managed to pick up a couple of points too. That stuff becomes really important about now.
Yes, because there is a tight championship, not for Cheka, but definitely between Melandri and Biaggi. And of course, the other
thing is too that I think they brought up during race one, maybe during race two, is. Do we walk into, and we haven't got to the end of this race yet, but do we walk into the end of the year with team orders?
Ah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
I don't see when Eugene Laverty is taking team orders very well.
Nah.
But you want me to what?
Exactly. Exactly.
Where are we?
So we had... Suddenly we had Chaz Davies up front and with a pretty decent gap. Meanwhile, Laverty had his own troubles because Camier, who, where did he start on the grid? He was seventh, so not that bad, but he had a shitty start in this race. Was able to catch Laverty and passed him. He passed him on lap 12.
I think it was lap 12, yeah.
So he was in third. Tux was still in second. And then, of course, they both... Actually, I think like a train of like four bikes ended up catching Sykes.
And it was essentially a carbon copy of race one, too.
Yeah. I mean,
frankly.
For that that aspect of it, absolutely.
Yeah. It was... whatever they have, I'm confident they'll figure it out. And when we look at the results of the race... he's closer than ever because the other guys at the top had issues too. So, and, you know, that's the thing, Jules. We think about it and we're like, okay, you know, Tom was doing a great job, then he had problems. Well, he finished both races near the front.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. He had a second and a fifth.
That ain't bad.
I'm sorry, and a fourth. And meanwhile, the guys he's competing against had Biaggi won the first race, but then he only got a 13th, and Melandri didn't score any points. So this was a good weekend for Sykes. Of course, it could have been a lot better had he been able to keep the pace.
I'm still pretty pleased. My fantasy league tightened up quite a bit with you and Martin.
Yeah, I think both Martin and I have Melandri.
Sorry about that. I got Tom and Juliana.
Right. Well, Juliana didn't help you much.
I still am much closer to you, lads.
Yeah, yeah. I have Sykes also, but yeah. Yeah, so now Biaggi's leading the championship by 9.5 points. And, God, we need another, you know, half race.
I like the fact that somebody could finish out by half a point down. correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, but I believe there were two races this year where they cut where the races had to be stopped before the end. I want to say Monza and wherever the first one was, that people ended up with half points. So it could have evened out and probably did even out for some riders.
No, I think it was last year. There was Nürburgring last year was a half race with half points. The one that Sykes won.
I think there was obviously at least one this year, and I think there may have been two.
No, it was just one. It was just Monza, dude. I'm looking at the chart here.
I guess there's no rounding up. Is
all
there?
The other winners got 25 points.
Yeah. So.
Oh shit! Wait a second, dude. Silverstone. Duh.
Yeah.
Silverstone was also half points.
Right.
Okay, you would.
Okay. Back up.
Yep. No, that's very interesting actually, because I just quickly scanned the chart and I'm like, oh shit, Silverstone had half points. You're absolutely right. All right, so and Sykes is only 26 and a half points behind with 100 points left on the table. That's
basically a race and
pretty freaking awesome.
13th place finish.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody else has to fall down. Or two other people have to fall down. I mean, I think it's a testament to the consistency that they've had on that bike.
Yeah.
And like we were just talking about, Tom hasn't crashed a lot this year. And to be honest, neither has Max or Melandri. But so think about this, Jules. We talk about this in racing a lot. If you're the guy that's in the lead, the thing you most want to have happen is the guys that are in second and third to start battling. Right.
Yep.
Well, Tom finds himself in a unique position that the guys in first and second are battling, and he's consistent and finishes races well.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, I'm looking at the chart. Biaggi DNF'd only two races. No, one race. Yep. Oh, two races. Sorry, two races. Yeah, because Moscow also, and Melandri. One, two, three, four.
Yeah.
And Sykes had two DNF. No, just one. Oh, two. Yep. Assen and Aragon.
Right.
So, Tom's consistency has been fantastic.
Sure. Yeah, on a bike that wasn't that consistent last year, or if it was consistent, didn't have the kind of setup that they've got this year. Absolutely hats off to that team. I mean, I want to see that kind of consistency within the bikes trickle down to, frankly, the National Series. Whatever you guys are doing is magic.
Yeah.
Can the rest of us have it? just killer. So what did we end up with? We ended up with, and I think this is astounding, and this may be, we had five RSV4s. Five Aprilias on the podium for World Superbike this weekend, and one, and this is an interesting honor, not even an honorable mention. Leon Camier on the podium as well in third place for race two. But I remember just a week ago when I was talking to James and I said, "So what the hell has happened to Fixie Suzuki?" He's like, "I don't know, I don't know what their issue is." And he sounded genuinely baffled. Well. They turned it around this weekend, at least for Leon, not necessarily for John Hopkins, who's still having a bit of a miserable season so far.
Yeah.
But it was really fun seeing those three guys, frankly, in Parc Fermé. I mean, they're all mates. And I, as I was watching the race and I was watching the aftermath, and I actually was not that impressed with the champagne fight on the podium.
Oh, you expected something a little more?
Yeah, I had a feeling there was going to be a true battle. There was not going to be a drop left in either of those bottles. But that being said, I suspect there were not many drops left in some of the pints that went down on Sunday night, which is one reason why I've probably not been able to get any of those bastards on the phone. So,
four Brits, an Irishman, and one of those Brits, a Welshman.
Yeah.
As you point out,
Chaz. So... just a great, great weekend for those guys. And I'm very, very pleased to see the Fixie Suzuki folks up near the pointy end. That's cool. And you know, the tall guys too. Hey.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Camier and Davis. So, very cool. Should we, anything else here? Oh, standings, right? Well, we already
yeah,
kind of touched.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's still Biaggi. Melandri and Sykes, but it's much tighter. It's much tighter between those three. And then, you know, Cheka and Jonathan Rea still mathematically have a chance of the championship, but, you know, it's not likely. 70 and 92 points, so not likely. Let's move to Super Sports really quick. It was actually a good race, which is It's funny that I'm saying I'm surprised, but this year it really has not been super sport, you know, excitement like we usually get. They've been fairly processional, you know. It's not that they've been huge gaps between the bikes, but there hasn't been that much passing. And this race was the same thing because Sefuaglu had the whole shot, and there was only a short moment on lap 14. Jules Cousel, who was tailing Sefuaglu the entire time, did repass him for a split second, I think 3 or 4 corners, and then Sefuaglu went Sefuaglu again. I always do this. Sefuaglu then went past him again, and then that was it. So it was like, you know, two passes basically for the lead. But it was not a boring race by any means, because we had a great battle for third. And Foray, I know you're not a big fan of him, but
I don't dislike Fabian. I mean, he's probably one of the most personality ridden people within the Supersport paddock. I like to tease him, but he's fast. He's quick.
He was absolutely relentless in this race.
Just yeah, and amazing. Yeah, he's passionate. And yeah. And he's old too, so I kind of dig that.
Right, well, he's 39, right?
He's up there.
Yep. And you know, Sam Lowes was looking really good, but unfortunately he made a big mistake and ran wide. He ran wide in one corner and then like did this strange, dropped the bike. He did end up picking it up and he did finish actually even in the points, but obviously his championship is pretty much done, I think.
Yeah.
It's really Sefuaglu's now because, I mean, Jules Cousel is in second, but there's no way he's going to catch him with only 2 races to go and 38 points. Sefuaglu will basically have to really, really, really suck the next 2 rounds. But this interesting statistic that was brought up, actually, it's an astounding statistic, which is that Sefuaglu has raced in 67 Supersport races. And he has been on the podium 47 times out of the 67, which is 70, and I put this in the notes, 70 effing percent of the races he finishes on the podium.
So, okay, so.
Massive.
Yeah,
and he's also 121.
It's his game. And it would be interesting to take the same number chart and percentage value when he was running in World Superbike and Moto 2.
Oh, and sucking.
Yeah, because it would be way down there. I think Supersport, it's basically his realm.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Something about the, you know, that's the combination of the, yeah, whatever, too many variables.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too in this race to see some cool names, even in seventh, Gebhard Tamashi.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, yeah. He looked good all the entire weekend, so that not surprising. Linov has been really awesome for the last maybe 4 or 5 rounds.
Yep.
Yeah, but it was good to see Tamashi up there. And was Linnertner a wild card? Because I don't recognize that name.
He is, yeah.
Okay, ninth place. So that was pretty cool. Right, so like I said, Sefuaglu has 198 points. Cousel is on 38, and then the next guy down, Foray, is already outside of the. He can no longer touch Sefuaglu with 54 points, and Sam Lowes with 57 because of that out of points finish in this one. So, I mean, Sefuaglu basically has this one sewn up, unless something really bad happens, and we hope that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so you also wanted to mention
a couple of other things.
Yeah.
We had BSB from Donington, and that was rounding out the rest of our fantasy league. But
man, did we have a good race there! One of those races was incredible.
We had several. I did manage. I haven't managed to watch the superbike rounds yet, unfortunately, from a timing perspective, but. Mm. One that I did make sure to get was the Super Stock round, which I don't always watch, but
I learned directly afterwards that an American, PJ Jacobson, who was over there running for the second round, third round, I think, for the Taiko Suzuki squad, formerly known as Taz, I believe. Was it? They used to be Taz? I think so. Won that race. And did so in a really cool fashion. He basically, he was in second place for 99.999976% of the race behind Lee Johnston, who PJ has raced against before, at least once, I believe. And passed him, coming out of the last corner. Lee spun it up just a bit on his Panigale, and PJ passed him on the outside in the grass.
Yeah.
Coming up. Coming off of the rumble strips, wheeling, no less.
Right.
One of the coolest pictures I've seen in a long time from Donington. There was an interesting conversation. People were like, well, did he take a shortcut? No, that's really not a shortcut. Not at Donington. If it had been wet, it would have been a bit of a mess, but it was beautiful. Actually, the weather at Donington was fantastic. It was perfect. Mm-hmm. What else is going on? So good job, PJ. We're going to try and have you on very shortly. And we'll see how that goes. Also at an AMA out of New Jersey Motorsport Park back east. And just very short, Josh Hayes continues to kick ass in AMA Pro Superbike. Won both races convincingly. So anybody out there in MotoGP, World Superbike, World Supersport, hell, BSB land, you guys need this dude. I'm telling you. He is the man, and we'll also be trying to get him on very, very shortly. I was pondering this earlier, this last couple of days ago. You know, Josh is hanging out down in SoCal, doing all this training with all these guys, all the Brits, right? You know, I'm like, he needs to get some, you know, Spaniards and Italians down there. They got better connections, or at least broaden his horizon to see what he could pick up. I'm joking, Josh, but it would be good. I think, you know, if the season, so he's already basically won the most races that, of anybody in a single season now after this last weekend. So he set that record.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's against like the Matt Milans and
Vince Fies
and so on. So, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
13 with four races left to go.
You should go hang out. You should go hang out with, Ben. Ben's so pretty much all Italian now. He's going to be on an Italian bike. He's got an Italian girlfriend. He lives in Italy.
That's true. I think he's only got an apartment now, though. It might be a little tight.
a house there.
He used to have that super plush villa. I think he's now... Well, anyway. We'll have to see. We'll have to see how that goes. But SoCal is definitely a place there people like to go and train. I mean, the weather's perfect there. I'm sure it's perfect out at Lake Como as well. I think, good Lord. Well, we butchered that, Jules. Do you think we can put this thing to bed?
Please. Dear gosh.
Shoot it in the head. All right. Well, folks, if you made it this far.
Thank you.
you're insane. Thanks so much for listening. Feel free to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. You can always write to us through there to motopod@motopodcast.com. You can catch us on Twitter at various addresses. You can also see the Twitter feed at our website. Getting some cool stuff there. Jules' photos are all popping up now. It's always fun to see what comes up with every new episode.
Yeah.
If you'd like to donate to the show, you can do it through the Facebook fan page or through the motopodcast.com page. We've got some interesting little promotions that are coming up soon for you guys. Get a chance to win some free stuff. It's always fun. I know you appreciate that. And with that, Jules, I'm going to get my ass to bed because it is rolling up on midnight.
It is. It is.
And I've got my other real work to do tomorrow. So... thanks so much for spending the time with us, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages. And we will talk to you next week.
All right. Ciao.